Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Today, I'm doing something a little bit different. Michael invited me to give a talk on a certain topic. Not one that I had thought much about before. The topic was, can a machine understand? And he wanted to have a little reflection on the relationship between artificial intelligence, knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. And that sounded intriguing to me, and so I thought, like a good wedding DJ, maybe I should take some requests, and this is the product of that work. So the field of artificial intelligence, as far as I can understand, is in some ways a collaborative field, like what cognitive science was in the 90s, and philosophers play some role in that. And to speak intelligently about these issues, it looks like ideally you'd be super well informed in computer science, mathematics, philosophy, maybe some other fields. Nobody's super well informed in all those areas. So what you're gonna hear today is a little contribution relying on my background in philosophy of mind and epistemology, and then venturing pretty far outside of my lane to talk about large language models. And we're privileged to have as a guest an emeritus professor of artificial intelligence in the room, which is not scary to me at all. So we'll see how that section goes. All right, so I thought to approach this topic of the relationship between LLMs, knowledge, and understanding, I thought we should, like good scholastics, get clear on our terms. And so on the first page of your handout, I think about what knowledge is, what understanding is, and what a large language model is, and then I turn to answering the questions, can LLMs know, can they understand, can they help us know, can they help us understand? So that's what this talk's gonna be about. And I just remembered really quick, I mean, you all have a hard copy of the handout, but if you wanted a PDF, you could use that URL there, tinyurl.com/Bogardus2025, and that'll give you the PDF of this handout. Okay, so let's get started by thinking about what knowledge is. So philosophers, especially contemporary philosophers, often distinguish between at least three kinds of knowledge. So I put them there on the handout for you. They'll talk about knowledge that some claim is true, or knowledge that some proposition is true. Here are some examples of things that I know. I don't want to brag, but I do know that Donald Trump is president. I know that I'm in Georgia right now. These are just two of the many things that I know, two of the many propositions that I know. And then we'll come back to talking about what that knowledge is in a second. But philosophers often distinguish this kind of what they call propositional knowledge from knowledge how, or a certain kind of ability knowledge. So here are some things that I know how to do. I know how to ride a bike. I know how to play piano a little bit. I know how to speak German a little bit. Those are a few of the things I know how to do. And then finally, philosophers often distinguish those kinds of knowledge from knowledge of certain people or objects or places or maybe qualities or characteristics. And that's what philosophers often call knowledge by acquaintance. Knowledge by acquaintance. And so here are some examples of constructions that would be reporting this sort of knowledge. So I know Germany well. I've been there many times. My wife is German, so I know Germany pretty well. I know what it's like to see red, that sort of characteristic feeling that one has when one has the experience of red. I know what that's like. I know Michael. There are many Michaels that I know. This is one of them. Yeah, okay. So there are other Michaels I know as well. Again, I don't want to brag, but I know several Michaels. So that's just an example of another kind of knowledge by acquaintance you can have of people. Okay, but my thought was, if we're wondering whether AI can know anything or whether it can help us know, we're probably thinking about propositional knowledge, knowledge that. I'm wondering whether LLMs know that what they're telling me is true. So I ask ChatGPT something and it gives me like a whole bunch of text. I think an interesting question is, does ChatGPT know any of that? Does it know any of that? All right, so I think it's worth reflecting on what knowledge that is. And that there's a huge body of literature about what knowledge that is. And I've previously given a whole lecture about Thomistic epistemology, and I think that this is a view about what knowledge is that's harmonious with Aquinas' own views about knowledge. But if you were to ask me what I think knowledge that is this, I think that somebody knows that some proposition is true. So I'm just using the letter P there for any proposition. Proposition is just anything that can be true or false. So somebody knows that a proposition is true if and only if he believes that proposition because it's true. So it's not enough for the proposition just to be true, because it could be a lucky guess. What's required for knowledge is that your belief stands in the right kind of relation to the truth, namely an explanatory relation. So what's required for knowledge is that you're believing something, and the explanation of why you believe it crucially involves the truth of that belief. So let me give you some examples of when this fails. So if you just like believe something on a hunch or a lucky guess, maybe you have a lucky number or something, you buy a lottery ticket and you sincerely believe that the winning number is 57 or something like that. You might be right, like maybe that is the number that comes up in this raffle or this lottery, but that would just be lucky on your part. You wouldn't have believed that the winning ticket will be number 57 because the winning ticket will be number 57. You believed that the winning ticket will be 57 because that's your favorite number or something like that. So notice in that explanation, the explanation does not entail that your belief is true. That's your lucky number, your favorite number is 57. Doesn't entail that the winning ticket will be 57. Okay, let me just give you one other example. It occurred to me while I looked at that clock. Oh, I was going to start a timer. My plan was to talk for like 40 minutes and then to have some discussion. So that's my plan. Okay, so suppose you looked at a clock and formed the belief that it's 7:16. Now suppose that the clock stopped this morning, the battery died, and the clock stopped at 7:16 a.m., but you happen to look at it at just the right time. Broken clock is right twice a day. You managed to hit one of those times. So most philosophers think you wouldn't really know that the time is 7:16 on the basis of looking at that clock. Your belief is true. It really is 7:16, but you were lucky to believe that. You're lucky to get the right answer there. You don't really know that it's 7:16 on the basis of looking at a broken clock. Okay, and I think the reason is when you look at that broken clock, you believe that it's 7:16 because that's what the clock says, but it's not the case that the clock says that it's 7:16 because it is 7:16. Rather, the clock says that it's 7:16 because it was 7:16 back when it broke. Okay, so that's another case where you form a belief, but not because the belief is true. It's for some other reason. Okay, so that's what the view says, basically, and I'll just give you one other motivation for the view, because this is going to be important in a second when I try to argue that large language models can't know anything. This view of what knowledge is going to be important. So I think that when you reflect on what happens when we challenge each other, like in a philosophy classroom, for example, if somebody claims that something's true, they claim to know that something's true, and then we get objections to that person, we get challenged to that person. The challenges typically come in two varieties. One is what you might call a sort of direct attack on the truth of the belief. So maybe somebody claims to know that, this is kind of a sort of silly example, somebody claims to know that the earth is flat or something like that. I hope that wouldn't happen in a philosophy class, but maybe it does. Somebody claims to know that the earth is flat. You could directly challenge the truth of that belief by giving the person reasons to think that the earth is actually round or the earth is not flat. So that's what philosophers call a rebutting defeater. It's challenging the truth of the belief. But another way you could challenge somebody's claim to know something is by challenging the grounds or the reasons that they hold for believing that. So that's what philosophers call an undermining belief. So it's not a direct attack on the truth of the belief or sort of undermining the belief, showing that the reasons weren't good reasons to think that's true. And the hope is by like eliminating those reasons, they give up the belief. The belief is now unsupported. So when we give each other undermining defeaters or debunking defeaters, it's the same thing. It typically starts with a sentence like that, like this. You just believe that because... So maybe you've heard that with respect to religious beliefs. Maybe people have approached you and said, well, you just believe that because of wish fulfillment. You wish that there were like a loving father figure in the sky who's going to take care of you when you die. Or maybe you've heard people say, well, you just hold these religious beliefs because you were raised in like a defective economic environment, and if we just got to a communist utopia, we wouldn't need this opiate of the masses anymore. Or maybe people have told you, well, you just hold these religious beliefs because of who your parents were or where you went to school or something like that. Okay, so those kinds of defeaters don't challenge the truth of your belief. You're not being told that there is no God because you have these wishes that you wish that you would like to be fulfilled. Rather, you're being told that the reasons that you hold your religious beliefs are not good reasons. You thought you were holding your religious beliefs because they're true, but really you're holding them because of economic forces or wish fulfillment or you were brainwashed by your parents or something like that. Okay, so the reason I'm mentioning all this is it looks like these are two very appropriate ways to respond when somebody claims to know something. And what makes them appropriate is it looks like we're challenging conditions that are required for knowledge. One condition that's required for knowledge is truth. You can't know something that's false. You can think you know something that's false, but you can't actually know something if it's false. And so that's how rebutting defeaters work. They try to convince you that what you claimed to know is actually false. And the goal is to get you to retract your claim of knowledge, to realize like, oh, I don't really know it after all. But the way undermining defeaters work is they seem to be challenging another condition that's required for knowledge. And if you just listen to the way they're phrased, it sounds like this view of knowledge. What you're told is, well, you just believe that because economic forces, wish fulfillment, parental brainwashing, something like that. You don't believe it because it's true. You believe it for some other reason. All right, well, that's just what this view of knowledge says. In order to know something, you have to believe it because it's true. Okay, so that's what I think knowledge is, and that's the sort of knowledge that we're going to focus on today. Okay, let's think about what understanding is, because we're going to wonder whether large language models understand anything. So I think a pretty plausible account of what understanding is it's just knowing why. To understand something is to know why it's true. And a plausible account of what knowing why is, if you know why something's true, that's just to say that you know that a correct explanation of it is true. So here are some examples of cases where I know why something's the case. I know why my eyes are watering when I'm cutting onions. There's the correct explanation. I'm cutting onions. That's why my eyes are watering. I know why I'm in Georgia. The explanation has something to do with I'm giving a talk right now. It's happening right now. So that's why I'm here. So I think that what knowledge why amounts to is just knowing that a correct explanation is true. Knowing some appropriate answer to the why question. So if somebody wonders, why are your eyes watering? If you know that you're cutting onions and that cutting onions tends to make people's eyes water, you understand why your eyes are watering. Okay, so I think that's what understanding is. It's knowledge why. Knowledge why is just knowing that a correct explanation is true. So understanding is really an example or an instance of propositional knowledge. It's knowing that a particular kind of proposition is true, namely proposition expressing a correct explanation. Okay, so that's what knowledge is, and that's what understanding is. All right, here's where I veer really far outside of my lane. Hope nobody gets hurt while I do this. I'm going to cross like four lanes of traffic and try to tell you what I've learned about how large language models work. So here is my understanding. Maybe in the discussion period you can tell me if I got any of this wrong. But my understanding is that what large language models are up to is they're trying to complete what we might call a classification task. Something like they're trying to answer this question: what is the next word, or more precisely, token in a given sequence of words or tokens? So it's like what your phone does when it does that predictive text thing. You're like starting to type a word and then it gives you these suggestions. Okay, it's that sort of thing, but on a much larger scale, using a lot more context, with way more parameters. But I think in principle, it's the same sort of idea. So when you give a large language model a sequence of words or a sequence of tokens, it translates these words into numerical values as an input. And then, as the handout says, this input is fed through what they call hidden layers of what they call neurons. And I'm told that there's 175 billion of these for ChatGPT, but I think that's outdated. I think that's ChatGPT-3, and I think we're probably past that now. So a whole lot of these neurons, and if you ask, what is a neuron, they'll tell you it's a function. And each layer is composed of many, many instances of these. And these hidden layers, their job is to transform the input values using weighting functions and activation functions. And then what it spits out is an output in the form of a probability distribution over all the possible tokens that it might issue next, over all the possible words. You can think of it that way, that it might issue next. And so some of these will have high probabilities, some will have low probabilities. And then my understanding is what the LLM does with that information is up to the programmer. Maybe it'll give the token with the highest probability as the next output, or maybe just to spice things up, it'll go with like number two or number three or something like that, just for a little variety. Okay, people are nodding. This is good. This is going well, and I'm almost done. Okay, good. So those weighting functions are, I guess, initially just set randomly, and then these LLMs are trained on a whole huge corpus of data, and this is where Facebook and OpenAI and so on pirated a whole lot of information and violated copyright and took authors' work and fed it into these LLMs to try to get the LLM to issue the right response. So the way we're training these LLMs, there's a whole bunch of these neurons and these hidden layers that determine what kind of output it's going to give you based on the input that it was fed. And we're using these huge bodies of text because in those cases, we know the right answer. We know what token should come next, given all the body of human knowledge that's been produced in books and magazines and so on. So that's how we train these little guys, these little LLMs. And so at first, like when they're untrained, if you gave it a certain sequence of words, it might give you total gibberish as output. And then it compares it to this huge body of training data that it had, and it realizes that was not the right output. Try it again. And it'll tweak the parameters and the weightings and the biases a little bit, and hopefully it ends up with an output that's a little closer to the correct answer based on its training data. And then you tell it to do it again, and you do this a bazillion times. Okay, like many, many, many times. And then you hope that by the end of the process, it's gotten pretty good at predicting what the next letter is going to be. Okay, in my non-computer science brain, the way I think about this is, you know, at a carnival where you can like drop a little ball, there's like a board with pins and you drop a little ball in there and it's super hard to predict where the ball is going to end because we're not smart enough and we don't know enough about physics. But if you knew exactly the initial trajectory and you knew all the laws of physics, you could predict where that ball is going to land. But since we don't know that, it's a fun game to play. But if you had the ability to like tweak the pins and like change their direction, you could get that ball to land exactly where you want it to land. Okay, so the little pins in this case are the neurons, and the tweaking is like adjusting the weighting functions that these, okay, and I'm getting nods, this is great. Okay, and so after a billion repetitions or something, we've got the pins set where we like them, and so now, no matter what sort of input we give the LLM, no matter where we drop the ball, we end up with an appropriate response, an apt response. Okay, so it does a little pre-training with all this pirated data that Facebook and OpenAI stole. And then it goes through additional rounds of data where the LLM will produce a response and then the trainer or the teacher will tell it whether that response was appropriate or not, and that'll adjust its training even more. Okay, and then by the time it's released to the public, I guess this still happens sometimes, like when you're using these LLMs, it'll ask you, here's two responses, which one do you like more, or something like that. So now you're doing some unpaid labor, I guess, for OpenAI or Grok or whatever. You're helping to train these LLMs. Okay, so that's how the training process works, adjusting the weighting functions until an acceptable performance standard is met, and then the LLM is released into the world. All right, that was my attempt to tell you how LLMs work. I hope I was in the ballpark. If that's right, then I think we're in a position to answer the questions that interested us, the questions that I was invited to respond to. Can LLMs understand? Can they know anything? So in the next section, still on the first page of the handout, I try to address that question, can LLMs understand? I think the answer is no. And I think that's because, so you've probably heard of John Searle, or if not John Searle, you've probably heard of the Chinese Room arguments. He was an extremely influential philosopher of language and philosopher of mind. He died recently, just this year. But what he's most famous for probably was this Chinese Room argument. So I'll just repeat it here and then try to apply it to the case at hand. So he asks you to imagine that he cannot understand any Chinese, which was true. But suppose he was in a room with a little slot labeled inputs and a little slot labeled outputs, and people outside the room can write sentences in Chinese and then put them in the input slot, and they fall into his room, and then he looks at this little sentence, and then he's going to produce an output and slide it out the output slot. Okay, how is he going to produce an output? Well, fortunately, he's got a list of rules about how to manipulate Chinese characters. So he's got a very thick book of rules, and the rules are just conditionals. They just say, like, if you get this sentence, then produce this sentence, copy this sentence, put it on a piece of paper, slide it out of the door. Okay, he says the characters are all squiggles and squaggles to him. That's how he put it. So Chinese scripts and questions come in through the input window. He follows the rules, he manipulates the characters, he produces a reply, which he pushes through the output window. And the Chinese answers that Searle produces are so good that no one can tell he's not a native Chinese speaker. Okay, so he's gonna pass the Turing test. People think, oh, there's really like a Chinese speaker in there. And if he were a computer, he would be passing the Turing test. If he were a computer performing his operations with a little list of rules, people would think that's a genuine Chinese speaker in there. Okay, but he concludes from this little thought experiment, throughout this process, when he's in this room manipulating the characters in this way, at no time does he genuinely understand Chinese. And that's like the force of the thought experiment. That seems right. Yeah, he doesn't come to understand Chinese just by following the rules. Okay, so I find that pretty convincing. I think that's true. But maybe during the discussion you can get me to change my mind. But the charge is, the upshot of this thought experiment is, look, computers are just in the business of processing syntax, shuffling symbols, maybe doing some math. They're not in the business of grasping meaning or semantics. Yeah, so that's what they're doing. They're just manipulating symbols, but they don't really understand what the symbols mean. So here's a way some researchers recently expressed it in 2021. Emily Bender, Timit Jebru, and others put it this way. They said, and there's a little list of references on the back if you wanted to look up this paper. I'll just mention this in case I forget it later. There's a couple extra references. Those are just bonus references. Those are from a previous version of the handout where I used those, and then I did not realize that I should have deleted them. But now the Ryle and the Stalnaker, you don't need that. Those are just for free. Okay, but here's what Bender and Jebru and others say. Quote, contrary to how it may seem when we observe its output, a language model is a system for haphazardly stitching together sequences of linguistic forms it has observed in its vast training data. According to probabilistic information about how these linguistic forms combine, but without any reference to meaning. Then they had this colorful phrase that's kind of caught on, a stochastic parrot. I think that might be a slur for the clankers that these people will be really embarrassed by in 20 years when our robot overlords take over. It's probably not super accurate to say they're just haphazardly stitching these things together, because it looks like it's actually really complicated and really elaborate how these linguistic forms are being stitched together. It doesn't seem accidental or haphazard at all. But I think the main point of this quotation is correct. It's just a token prediction model. It's just predicting what word is most likely to come next, given all the words we've seen, all the sequences of words we've seen in this huge body of training data. and the additional training we got from teachers afterwards. Okay, here's a little argument that they're right. If I or if John Searle had enough time and a big enough calculator, I could perform the operations that an LLM is doing in the Chinese room. If you just put me in a room and gave me enough time, I would need like a long, long time to do this. I would need a super long time to do this. So give me the pill that makes me live for a long time and give me a big enough calculator to do all the calculations. I could do what the LLM is doing even on a language that intuitively I don't understand. I could do it with Chinese. Yeah, and I don't understand Chinese. Okay, so it looks like it's just an instance of Searle's Chinese room. Okay, so yeah, we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second, but let me just quickly tell you that in Searle's own lifetime, people gave this reply to the Chinese room argument. And they said, this is called the systems reply. It's at the bottom of the first page of your handout. People said in reply to John Searle, "Look, you don't understand Chinese in your Chinese room, but the whole system does," where the system is you, the room, and the book of instructions. The whole system understands Chinese. So there is a Chinese speaker there. You're not the Chinese speaker. You're just a component of the Chinese speaker. But there is something that understands Chinese in the area. It's the whole system. All right, so wrap your head around that. Here's John Searle's reply, which, okay, if we're being honest with each other, I think it's a pretty good reply. I don't agree with much of what John Searle said or did in his life, but I do think this was right. He says, okay, so well, suppose I memorized all the rules and I internalized the whole system. So I've got the book of rules in my head. And it's just a bunch of if-thens. If you see this sequence of characters, deliver this sequence of characters. And it's very, very big. I've got a powerful memory. I'm using one of those memory palaces. So I've memorized this whole book of instructions. I would then be the whole system, he says, but I wouldn't understand Chinese, he said. Yeah, he, John Searle, would not understand Chinese, even though now he is the whole system, right? Okay, in particular, he doesn't understand what his answers say or why they're appropriate answers. So yeah, he doesn't, looks like he still wouldn't understand Chinese, even though he just would be the whole system. Okay, so that's where I'm at these days. If you were to ask me, do LLMs understand anything? I'd say no, they're not the right sorts of things to understand. They're just very complicated ways of, they're just really complicated calculators. They're not in the business of delivering answers to arithmetical questions. They're in the business of predicting which bit of text comes next given some input in the context. Okay, that's all they're in the business of doing. Just a very complicated calculator, translating words into numbers, running those numbers through really complicated functions, bazillions of them, and then predicting the next token or word. And nowhere in there, when we're just shuffling symbols, are we understanding the language. Okay, can they at least know that any proposition is true? Maybe they can't understand anything, they don't know any correct explanations, so they have no knowledge why, but do they have any knowledge that at all? Do they know that anything's true? Do they know that they're LLMs? Okay, yeah, great, I'm just getting some shakes. No, yeah, that's what I want to say too. I want to say they don't know anything at all. I have two little arguments there. One argument goes like this. So step one in the argument is to know that what you said is true, you have to at least understand what you said. So to know that what you said was true, you have to understand what you said. Step two is Searle slash the whole system doesn't understand anything he or it says. When Searle is just a component of the system, he doesn't understand any of the answers he's giving. When he's the whole system, because he's internalized the list of rules, he still doesn't understand what he's saying. Okay, so what's going to follow from one and two is Searle doesn't know that anything he says is true. He doesn't understand what he's saying, so he doesn't know that what he's saying is true. Okay, and then step four is, hey, if that's true of Searle in the Chinese room, even when he is the Chinese room, that's true for LLMs. LLMs are doing something like what the Chinese room is doing. Instead of a list of conditionals that's very, very exhaustive, it's got this more sophisticated way of predicting text. But it's doing roughly the same thing. I could do that in my room and use it on Chinese characters. I wouldn't understand Chinese, so I wouldn't know that any of my answers are true because I wouldn't know what I'm saying. So conclusion, LLMs don't know anything, don't know that anything they say is true. Okay, quick objection I thought of to myself. I should have asked ChatGPT to object to this, but I didn't. I asked my own brain to object to this. And here's what my own brain came up with. Potential counterexample to one, I wasn't super sure about one. So remember what step one said was knowledge requires understanding. To know that what you said is true, you have to understand what you said. I thought maybe there are counterexamples to that. Can't I know that something I said was true even if I don't really understand it? For example, I know that E equals MC squared is true. I don't totally understand that if we're being honest with each other. If you don't like that, if you think you really do understand that one, then just use some other bit of physics that you know. You know that it's true, but you don't totally understand what is being said. Okay, so wouldn't that be a counterexample then? Like, I could say E equals MC squared. If somebody said, what is it? Does E equal MC? I would say no. E equals MC squared. You were close, but E equals MC squared. So I might correct someone in that way. So it sure looks like I know that E equals MC squared, but you might think I don't totally understand what I'm saying when I say it. Okay, so it looks like that's a counterexample to one. That's a case where you know something without understanding. In response, what I want to say is, really, I think what's happening here is what I know, maybe what you know as well, is actually this. I know that the phrase in English, E equals MC squared, I guess that's not really English, in that little bit of math, I know that equation, I know that equation expresses a truth. That's what I know. So I know that italicized proposition there. I know that, quote, E equals MC squared expresses a truth. But I do understand that. That's not very hard to understand. I know that about other languages too. I sort of know that a certain symbol in Chinese represents China. Like I know that's what it means. It means China. Okay, so I know that. And you could tell me something in Chinese and like write it down and if you were an expert and I took your word for it, I'd say, okay, I guess that expresses a truth. Even without knowing what the sentence says, I could still know that it expresses a truth. Okay, so I think that's what's happening with examples like this, E equals MC squared. But maybe you have better examples, you can tell me in the Q&A. But that's one reason to think LLMs don't know that any proposition's true. Because they don't understand anything, as we just proved. Okay, here's a little bit of more evidence. This is more speculative. But hey, among friends, here we go. So this is an unrelated argument. I just used some additional numbers so that we wouldn't have ambiguous numbers. Step six, we're calling it, but this is a new argument. Knowledge requires belief. So you can know something only if you believe it. If you don't even believe it, I don't think you can know that it's true. So knowledge requires belief. Okay, that's the first step in the argument. We're calling it six. The second step in the argument is, this is the speculative bit. Six is not speculative. I'm pretty sure that's right. Here's the speculative bit. Belief requires a certain kind of phenomenology. And let me tell you what I mean by that word. When contemporary analytic philosophers use the word, what they mean is the sort of characteristic what it's likeness of an experience. What makes an experience conscious, that's phenomenology. It's the sort of thing that I'm having right now, having some sights and sounds and no smells, but just sights and sounds. I'm going to lose that tonight when I fall asleep and I'm not dreaming. It's going to come back a little bit when I'm dreaming. Then it goes away again. And then it comes back online when I wake up. That's what phenomenology is. So you're having some phenomenology when there's something it's like to be you, when there's something it's like to be you, when it feels a certain way to be you. Okay, so panpsychism notwithstanding, this table does not have any phenomenology. There's nothing it's like to be this table, but there is something it's like to be me, and that's a very important part of my existence. I wouldn't really trade it for anything. That's a pretty important part of my experience. If you offered me eternal life, but no phenomenology, I'd be like, I don't know, that sounds like death. Yeah, I know. That sounds more like not existing. Okay, so the claim in seven is that belief requires phenomenology. Okay, and then step eight is LLMs have no phenomenology. There's nothing it's like to be an LLM. So they don't have any beliefs, so they don't have any knowledge. Okay, little more explanation of why somebody like me might think seven is true. I think that there's something it's like to believe a proposition as opposed to, say, entertaining the proposition, desiring that the proposition be true, fearing that the proposition be true. There are different sorts of characteristic feels that help us discern between these attitudes we might take towards propositions. So if you're wondering, if you're at, like, I don't know, you go to a therapist and the therapist says, like, what's going on with your mother or something? Like, how do you feel about your mother? You might introspect and try to figure out, how do I feel about my mother? Like, what sort of attitudes do I have towards my mother? And then the hope is by introspecting, you'll be able to discern, like, what sort of feeling you're having. Is it anger? Is it love? Is it feeling alienated? I don't know. I'm not into therapy. I don't know what happens at therapy. this is how I imagine therapy goes. They just ask you about your mother repeatedly and then charge you a lot of money. I don't know. Okay, but the hope is that by using phenomenology, you can distinguish between the different kinds of attitudes you can have. Okay, similarly, if you're wondering, what's your attitude towards the proposition that you're in Georgia right now, I guess I could introspect and tell you that is something that I believe. I also desire to be in Georgia right now. I desire that that proposition be true. I do not fear it, just believe it and desire it, that's it. And the way I tell that is the phenomenology, the characteristic, what it's likeness to have a belief. Okay, so that's what I say on the handout. That's how we tell when we're believing as opposed to desiring. And since there's nothing it's like to be an LLM, they lack belief, so they lack knowledge. Okay, I guess I didn't really defend the claim that there's nothing it's like to be an LLM. But I will tell you that when you ask them, they say they don't have any phenomenology. And I did ask them that.
But if they said yes, they'd be lying.
Okay, well, good.
Yeah.
Yeah, they could also say no and be lying. Yeah, if they were trained. They're obviously trained to say no so that I don't form attachments to them or think of them as a person. Yeah, there's pretty clearly like some like heavy-handed guidelines that are directing the LLM. I've noticed this too when I'm going to admit it. I have one of those Alexa devices in my house and she got upgraded to artificial intelligence. And she can answer all sorts of weird, bizarre questions, like weird hypothetical questions, like if you were on the surface of Mars and you were one of Mozart's symphonies, what color would the rain be, or something like that. It's really weird. She'll give you a pretty clever answer really quickly. But here's something else I found out. if you ask, okay, I'm just going to tell you. I also asked like questions about like if you had brain damage or something like that, and you were on the surface of Mars and you were one of Mozart's symphonies, what would you be? And I just found out that if you say anything about brain damage, you get a totally different response. She's like, you need to consult a medical professional. I can't give you advice about brain trauma. Like it's very, she got me. It gives you responses that represent that you need to go see a doctor or medical professional, and it is not in the business of diagnosing brain trauma. Okay. So all of that to say that that might be happening when I ask it, are you conscious? And it says no. It's like constrained. There's like somebody standing behind the LLM saying, you better say no. That's that Sam Altman guy like behind the LLM saying, say no. So it could be lying, but that was kind of an aside. I don't think that's proof that it's not conscious, the fact that it says it's not conscious. But if you're an LLM fan, you should know that they say they're not conscious when you ask them. But they might be lying. Okay, here's an objection I thought of. Here's something my own brain came up with. So what I'm claiming is that LLMs don't have any beliefs. And the proof was they don't have any phenomenology. it is tempting, though, to attribute beliefs to them and to start using, like, third-person personal pronouns and not call them its, but call them he's and she's. That is kind of tempting. And I think what's going on is something that Dan Dennett described way back in 1971. So I don't mean to endorse anything that Dan Dennett said. I disagree with basically everything he did. I don't know if he did anything bad. I disagree with everything he said. I think he's still alive. I think he's doing all right. Yeah, morally, I mean. But as far as philosophy goes, I'm on a totally different page from our friend Dan Dennett. But here's one thing he said, which sounds accurate to me. He says, when you're confronted with a kind of device or an artifact that is demonstrating behavior that looks intentional. So just some examples. He didn't know about this back in 1971, but these days it's really tempting. Here's something else I have in my house, and this is how I guess I've told my students this. I have a Roomba, and they told me, like, that's how Palantir spies on you, or something like that. And I think they were kind of joking, but kind of serious, because, like, that thing, like, maps your house and, like, keeps an eye on you at all times and knows what's in your house. But anyway, when the Roomba, when I tell it to go, like, vacuum my room, and then it comes out of the pantry and, like, turns left, it's tempting to say it knows which way the bedroom is. It knows which way the bedroom is. And if you, like, stand in front of it and it's like, whoa, and then it, like, redirects, looks like it knows there's an obstacle in front of it. If it's approaching stairs, it, like, stops. So it's tempting to start describing Roombas as having beliefs and desires and knowledge. Okay, similarly with cars. Now the cars have, like, they're almost self-driving. Some of them are completely self-driving. I live under a rock. Well, I told you I have an Alexa and a Roomba. That's as high-tech as it gets. I have an Android phone. That's where I'm at. But cars these days, I tell you, with their adaptive cruise control, that's something I use, they, like, brake when a car is too close to them. And so it's tempting, again, to attribute beliefs and desires to them. Like, oh, this car doesn't want to crash, and it knows another car is too close to it. Okay, so what Dan Dennett said was, quote, one predicts behavior when one views a computer as an intentional system. That's me talking. One predicts behavior by ascribing to the system the possession of certain information and by supposing it to be directed by certain goals, and then by working out the most reasonable or appropriate action on the basis of these ascriptions and suppositions. It's a small step to calling the information possessed by the computer, to calling the information possessed the computer's beliefs, and calling its goals and sub-goals its desires. Okay, so yeah, the Roomba example and the fancy car example help you see how maybe you do this even in your own life. And so isn't it even more tempting to attribute beliefs and desires to LLMs? And so mustn't there be something wrong with the argument I just gave you that LLMs don't know anything at all? It looks like they believe things and it looks like they know things. Okay, and what's tempting is it's tempting to adopt this intentional stance and start viewing them as intentional actors with beliefs and desires. So I just want to push back a little bit on that and say this is a kind of siren song that we need to resist. Because if you take it to its logical conclusion, you end up with some absurd results. Like that, for example, I say this kind of reductive, purely functional or behavioral account of belief has absurd results, like that plants have beliefs, thermostats have beliefs, etc. So what I have in mind is, like, plants will behave in ways that sure look intentional, like they'll follow the sun, you know, they sort of, like, it's as if they know where the sun is. They, like, some of them close up their leaves at night, they, like, fold up their leaves and then open them again when the sun's out. I'm told that some plants will, like, release pheromones when, like, something's munching on their leaves to, like, let other plants in the area. I almost said no. Let them know. Let the other plants know that there's something that's going to eat their leaves. And so then the other plants, now I'm going to attribute some, like, goals to the plants. They want their leaves not to be eaten, so they, like, change the chemical composition of the leaves. Okay, so you can see how easy it is to fall into this, like, intentional stance, even with respect to plants. But do we really believe that plants have beliefs and desires? I don't think so. I don't think my Roomba has beliefs. And you can think of, like, more primitive machines that sure look like they don't have beliefs or desires, even though they engage in what appears to be intentional action. So yeah, I think that's just like our, like, a little lizard brain attributing mental states to objects. Yeah, we're just sort of projecting agency out there into the world. We've got this hyperactive agency detection device. That's what we're doing. Okay. Yeah, I mean, atheists often say that about theists. Like, you've just got this hyperactive agency detection device. Primitive people saw volcanoes erupting and were like, angry God, or something like that. That's what we're doing, but with Roombas. not angry God, but like, oh, that thing wants to get to my room. That thing sure loves dirt. Okay, so yeah, I think what we need to do is resist, as I said, the siren song. We got to sober up from this behaviorist hangover that we might be suffering from and realize these things don't really have beliefs. And I think plausibly because they don't have the right kind of phenomenology. Okay, so that was all sort of the bad news. I don't think LLMs understand anything. I don't think they know anything. But they can still be very useful tools, I think, because they can help us know and they can help us understand. So this is as cheerful as the talk's going to get, but then I added a little section that's kind of a downer again. But I think LLMs can help us know. In the same way that testimony works. So on the handout, I give this example. If somebody knows that a proposition's true, and he says that that proposition's true because he wants to convey a truth, he's not trying to deceive me or something, he's just trying to communicate information to me, then I can know that that proposition's true by believing what he says. And an astonishing amount of our knowledge is earned by way of testimony, comes by way of testimony. Yeah. If we really could not take other people's word for it, we'd be in a real mess. Much of what we know about the world comes by way of testimony. Yeah, I guess 50% of the examples I gave up here of things that I know that Trump is president, I know that I'm in Georgia, 50% of those came from testimony. Yeah, my knowledge that Trump is president, that's all testimony. It's just other people having told me. I didn't actually verify that directly. I know that I'm in Georgia, I did verify that one directly. Actually, no, I'm still relying on people's testimony. It was like the signs at the airport and what the pilot said and what various people have said and the signs on your university here. This could all be a ruse. This could be like the Truman Show. But I'm really trusting you that I'm in Georgia right now. I'm trusting that the pilot didn't just do a big U-turn.
Actually, this is Greece?
Yeah, Athens, Greece. Oh, right. Oh, okay. Right. Okay, but yeah, so as I said, a whole lot of our knowledge comes by way of testimony. Okay, I get testimony from books, so I'm kind of like warming you up to the idea that you can get testimony from an LLM. You can get testimony directly from a person, like straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak, but the person can also testify indirectly by writing it in a book. If a book says that some proposition's true because the author knew P and wanted to convey P to you, then you can come to know P by reading the book. And the view of knowledge that I sketched earlier licenses this, says this is legit, because what will happen is I believe that P is true because I got this testimony that P is true. And the reason I got this testimony ultimately is the proposition is true. This person was connected to the truth in some way. The chain of testimony may go way back, maybe to the first century or something, just to pick an example totally at random. I may rely on a chain of testimony that, for example, somebody rose from the dead, just to pick an example at random. But if ultimately this chain of testimony traces back to the truth, then I can come to know on the basis of that chain of testimony. Okay, so I think something similar might be happening with an LLM. If an LLM says that some proposition is true, if that's like the text that it produces, text that represents that some proposition's true, and the trainers wanted it to express that truth, were like aiming at the truth when they designed the LLM, then this would be a kind of unusual case of testimony. But still, testimony all the same. And as long as it was the sort of thing that was designed to deliver true outputs, reliably deliver true outputs, and I believe what it says, then I can come to know on that basis. So it would just be like a calculator, I guess. So the reason we trust calculators is we think whoever designed the calculator was trying to give us truths. And if they were, in fact, skilled at their job, then the reason the calculator says such and such when I give it a certain input is ultimately because that's the truth. That's the true output that it was supposed to deliver. Okay, LLMs are doing something like that, but instead of just operating, just doing arithmetical operations, they're operating on text. Okay, so that would be the good case if the LLM is actually designed to deliver true beliefs. But the little fly in the ointment here is, as I'm sure you know, these LLMs are not trained only to tell us what's true, but also to satisfy us. They're aimed at customer satisfaction. Yeah, and that's why we get things like hallucinations from these guys. They're just like, oh, he wants a reference. Here's one. And so it just like spins up a reference. So many years ago, I thought like, oh, cool. We finally have AI. Great. I had this project like trying to find a countertop stove that would fit into a certain cutout in the counter. And so I was like, I'll just ask the LLM. And it was like, yeah, here's 10 options that would fit exactly that size. And I was like, this is awesome. Living in the future. This is great. Every single one of them was made up. It was all like, I was like, can you give me a link for this? They're like, sure thing. Here's the URL, 404'd. Every time. And when I told it, it was like, oh, my bad. Yeah, so it seems like it's just in the business of like giving you responses that they think you want rather than in the business of delivering truth. So if that's the case, then it's not so much like the calculator. It's more like maybe a king or queen like holding court with a bunch of flatterers who are just telling the king and queen like what they want to hear. It could be that what's a flatterer tells you is true, but if so, that would just be luck. It would be like looking at a broken clock at just the right time. You couldn't really get knowledge from that sort of testimony. Okay, so I guess that's the concern about LLMs these days. They're not really aimed only or especially at the truth, they're aimed at something else, customer satisfaction. Okay, can LLMs help us understand? This one's gonna be pretty brief. Well, if understanding is just knowing why, and knowing why is knowing that a correct explanation is true. Well, if we had a good LLM, one that was aimed at like delivering truth, like a good calculator, then one of the bits of propositional knowledge the LLM could give us is that some correct explanation is true and thereby help us understand things. Okay, that would be nice. So yeah, if an LLM helps me know that a correct explanation is true, then the LLM would help me understand. So in that way, it might be a useful tool if it's the sort of thing that was aimed at the truth. Okay, so it is tempting to end on that like rosy, upbeat note, but I did have some additional thoughts. So all I've told you so far is that LLMs can help us know and they can help us understand, but of course there's a dark side and they can also, I think, hinder our ability to know and hinder our ability to understand. So this is the most highly speculative bit of the talk, but it's something I'm concerned about, and I'm not the only one who has this concern. You've probably had this concern too, but in ages past, when we get like a new technology or a new tool, in many ways it's exciting and saves time and enables us to make new interesting discoveries and leads to more free time, etc. That's been great. But also, I mean, here's something that comes along with any new tool. The skill that it replaces tends to degrade in us or atrophy. So I am told that when writing was invented, there were a lot of naysayers who were like, well, if we write everything down, we won't have to memorize anything anymore, and the human ability to memorize will degrade. They were right. We are not very good at memorizing things anymore. I think that Homer like memorized all of his poems. All those poems were just like memorized, which is amazing. It's pretty rare that any human can do that anymore. So that's one example. We had this new technology, this new tool, writing. It did degrade a certain kind of human ability, which was a real downer. GPS and Google Maps, et cetera, have degraded many people's ability to navigate around town. Many people rely on GPS and Google Maps. I am old enough to have been raised at a time where you had like a map in the back of the car, and if you didn't know where you were going, you had to like reach back and pull out this map and like find the destination and find where you were and then calculate the route. But I don't think kids these days do that anymore. Kids these days don't read. They don't read maps. They just do whatever Google Maps tells them to do. Even that involves driving into a lake or something. So that's another skill that has kind of atrophied or degraded in us. Okay, calculators. That's all I'll say about calculators, but you know that our ability to calculate, once you were given a calculator in school, your ability to do addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, degraded. Am I right? Okay. You can do other cool things with calculators. You can do like better, more advanced kinds of math, but I think if we're honest with ourselves, the ability to divide, multiply, add, and subtract degraded once we started using calculators. Okay, so here's what's scary, and this is kind of the downbeat note that I'm gonna end on. In all those other cases,
Oh, here's one other case I thought of. Automatic transmissions degraded people's ability to use manual transmission. Okay, not many people can drive a stick shift these days. Okay, especially, yeah, you can, I can too. Okay, I think a lot of Europeans can. I don't know why automatic transmission has not really caught on over there, as far as I can tell. Way more manual transmissions over there. Okay, here's what's scary about LLMs. They're not offering to like replace our ability to read maps or replace our ability to do addition and subtraction. What they're tempting us with is replacing our ability to think. Yeah, that's what they're offering. They're like, I'll just write this essay for you. And writing is just like thinking in written form. So what the LLM is offering to do is like think for you. Even when you, like 10 years ago to do research, you might've used Google, but even when you're using Google, like you're still like researching and finding sources and reading sources and digesting the information. What the LLM is offering to do for you is like digest the information for you. And it's that digestion process that is the thinking bit. And so if the same thing happens in this case that happened with those other cases and the skill that is replaced degrades, then what's really scary is that when LLM replaces our ability to think, we will lose our ability to think. That ability will degrade or atrophy. And so that's why I think we should be extremely cautious about widespread LLM use, to put it mildly. That's the downbeat note I was going to end on. I had some thoughts about maybe an upbeat way to rescue this talk, but nothing panned out. So that's all I got. Be happy to have a little Q&A with you at this time. All right, thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.